Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. My apologies for the delay in the beginning of the program, and my apologies to the author. We didn't provide him with accurate directions to the venue, and as a result, he is delayed. He was delayed, but mercifully, he found his way here, and I thank him very much for doing that. My name is David McKnight. I am the director of the Rare Book and Manuscript Library and the curator of the Schoenberg Center for Electronic Text and Image. I'd like to welcome you to this evening's event, which is co-sponsored by the Lorraine Beitler Collection on the Dreyfus Affair Events Committee and the American Jewish Committee, Philadelphia, South New Jersey Division, and also homage to the Alliance Française, which was also instrumental in part in terms of the collaboration for having our author event this evening. In light of that, I'd just like to take a moment to thank Elena Kropp-Wilensk, who is here this evening as the director of the AGC, and her co-director, Rebecca Karp. I'd also like to acknowledge Danielle Easton, who is representative of the Alliance Française. She is stranded in Paris, a difficult situation to be in, I understand. But nevertheless, she's unable to be with us here this evening, and she sends her regards. I'd also like to thank Michael Fox from Joseph Fox Books, who has kindly sent over a staff member and a number of books that are on sale this evening, and there'll be an opportunity to meet the author and purchase a copy and have him sign your copy as well. And I'd also like to thank Kristen Stromberg-Childers from the Department of History, who will introduce our speaker this evening. I would just like to take a moment to mention that among the prize collections that we have here in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library is the Lorraine Beitler Collection on the Dreyfus Affair. It's a significant collection which includes broadsides, periodicals, international newspapers, personal letters, drawings, lithographs, photographs, ephemera, and decorative arts. This collection was assembled by Lorraine Beitler, one of our dear friends and donors here in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library. This collection is a remarkable document which illustrates both the affair and also, in many senses, the response of the media in France at the time and elsewhere, given its international scope. And we are actively working on the collection. We've developed a sophisticated web presence for the website for the collection, so that you're able to view documents. We have a series related to scholar interviews based on individuals who have participated in previous Lorraine Beitler events. We are at this time planning a conference in 2011 focusing on human rights in the media. Dreyfus inspires many responses and many reactions, and in many respects, the author this evening has summarized why the and investigated and analyzed why the Dreyfus Affair matters. But I will leave that to Mr. Begley to describe and define. We have basically a program that consists of an introduction, remarks, period for questions. We also have, while you're purchasing a book and meeting with the author, we have refreshments, so I hope you will take advantage of that. And so what I'd like to do now is invite Kristen. Oh, yes, and of course, my colleagues remind me. We also have samples from the collection on view in the Lee Library, so after the program has ended, feel free to look at the materials on display. It's fascinating material, including a wonderful original copy of Jacques Hughes, which is one of the instruments that was used at the time to promote Dreyfus's eventual liberation. So with that, I'd like to invite Kristen to come forward and introduce our author. Thank you.
Good evening, and welcome to this special lecture and book signing by Louis Begley. Louis Begley was born in a town in Poland that is now part of Ukraine. As a young boy during the war, he survived alongside his mother by assuming a Catholic identity and evading the Nazi roundup of Jews in Poland. Reunited with his father after the war, he and his family left Krakow in 1946 and traveled first to Paris and then on to New York. He attended Harvard, where he studied literature, and later graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School. He embarked on a successful career with a prominent New York law firm, but also heeded the call of literature, writing several novels over the next years. Wartime Lies, published in 1991, won the Penn Hemingway Award for first work of fiction. The French translation, Une éducation polonaise, won the Prix Medici Étranger. Begley's other novels include The Man Who Was Late, As Max Saw It, About Schmidt, which was made into a major motion picture, Shipwreck, and Matters of Honor. He's received numerous awards in the U.S. and around the world, including the Irish Times Aer Lingus International Fiction Prize and the American Academy of Letters Award in Literature, as well as been a National Book Award finalist and National Book Critics Circle finalist. He is a past president of the Penn American Center, a global literary community protecting free expression and celebrating literature, and also was made a Chevalier in the Ordre des Arts et Lettres in recognition of his significant contribution to the enrichment of French culture. Tonight, Louis Begley will be talking to us about his most recent book, Why the Dreyfus Affair Matters, which has won acclaim from critics and audiences alike. Adam Gopnik praised it in The New Yorker as a brave book, explaining that it was, quote, brave because Begley wants to use the occasion not for French bashing or for reciting the enduring history of European anti-Semitism, bleak as it is, but as a pointed warning and reminder of how fragile the standards of civilized conduct prove in moments of national panic. The Dreyfus Affair matters, he believes, because we have, in the past decade, made our own Devil's Island and hundreds of new Dreyfuses. The Dreyfus Affair matters because we're still in the middle of it, unquote. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Louis Begley.
Thank you, David McKnight. Thank you, Christoph Stombach-Schilders. Thank you all. If I were a tenor about to sing at the Metropolitan Opera, the manager would come out and say that I'm indisposed. The fact is that I have terrible hay fever, and I'm usually inaudible, and today I'm probably more inaudible than ever. Can you all hear me in the back?
Yes?
Well, that's good. I should also say that I apologize for being late, but we had a lively trot around the campus before we found our way here. The Dreyfus Affair is so complicated that to undertake to talk about it in the space of 25 or 30 minutes is a sort of Dreyfus malpractice. But I'm going to go right ahead and try to do my best. We all know what happened to Captain Dreyfus. In July 1894, a French army major called Esterhazy went to visit the German military attaché in Paris and offered to sell him French military secrets. Esterhazy was a man whom one might, describe as a social psychopath. He was horribly in debt. He had thought of all conceivable ways of getting money from his friends, of becoming a mercenary for the Pasha of Egypt, or the king of Greece. Nobody wanted him, and no one wanted to extend to him credit. So he decided he would trade on his uniform and on his knowledge of French military matters, which in fact was slim. Schwarzkoppen accepted the offer, And in the first days of September 1894, Esterhazy delivered a first batch of documents to Schwarzkoppen, received payment of 1,000 francs, and he sent to Schwarzkoppen a little list which became known as the bordereau, on which were written down the items that he had transmitted. That list was presumably read over by Schwarzkoppen. He then tore it into little bits, threw it in his wastebasket. From his wastebasket, the bordereau torn up made its way to the Section de Statistique, which was the French General Staff's counterintelligence unit. There it was put together by Major Henri, who was to become one of the principal figures in the Dreyfus case. Immediately, he and his superiors and colleagues realized there was a real traitor, probably working within the Ministry of War, perhaps on the General Staff. And of course, it was their task to find the traitor. They weren't getting far until one officer suggested that the culprit had to be an artillery officer, because the major item on the bordereau was a manual concerning the short 120 millimeter cannon that the French were developing, and that it probably had to be an officer who was a trainee on the General Staff, because the range of subjects was such that it would seem to be that the officer had to move from bureau to bureau. Well, the trainees' names were pulled together, and samples of their handwritings were obtained. And one name stood out. That was of Captain Alfred Dreyfus. Why? Well, because he was a trainee officer, because he was an artillery officer, and because his handwriting seemed to them to resemble the handwriting on the bordereau. Soon they gained certainty that the handwritings were identical. Actually, the views of the experts on that point were divided. But that division of views and the absence of any possible motive for Dreyfus to be doing this, to be betraying his country, did not deter them. Dreyfus, by the way, was rich. He had a brilliant record thus far. He was happily married to a beautiful and rich wife and had two children. But he also happened to be Jewish. That was anomalous. He was surely the only Jewish officer serving on a general staff in Europe. And while these officers who were conducting the investigation were not looking for a Jew to make him a victim, his being Jewish was peculiarly convenient. Why? Because the army is incarnated by the Minister of War, who was General Mercier, and the Chief of Staff, General de Boisdeffre, were aghast at the thought that a French officer could be spying. Well, if the French officer happened to be a Jew, the damage to the army's self-esteem was not nearly the same. Perhaps there was no damage to the army's self-esteem. Perhaps all that that proved was that Jews were not real Frenchmen, that a Jewish officer had no true links of loyalty to his country. Anyway, General Mercier ordered the arrest of Dreyfus, and also the interrogation of Dreyfus in secret, searches of his apartment. None of the above produced any results. After a couple of weeks, to the officer who was conducting the investigation, Patit de Clam told Wadefre and Mercier that there really was no proof against Dreyfus except for the bordereau, and that there was a good likelihood of acquittal if he were court-martialed. You would think that at that point, Mercier might have decided to drop the matter. But there had been leaks to newspapers. And in the climate of the day, the fact that the Jewish officer, because Dreyfus's name was divulged, suspected of treason, arrested, and then released, would have brought about a storm of vituperation against Mercier, he thought, because he was coddling the Jews and knuckling under to the powerful Jewish banking interests. Therefore, Mercier lowered his head and had Dreyfus stand trial. In preparation for the trial, Mercier also ordered the assembly of documents that could be used to prove Dreyfus's culpability. This was really flotsam and jetsam. None of it incriminated Dreyfus if left alone, but it was subtly altered, this information, and was accompanied by a memorandum that gave the documents the slant that was needed. In particular, the documents included a letter from the Italian military attaché to the German military attaché, in which there was a reference to someone, cette canaille de deux, that swine D. Well, that it turned out later, many years later, that D in question was Monsieur Dumas, who sold to the Italians the plans of the fortifications of Nice. But it was easy to give it another slant and to say that they were clearly referring to Dreyfus. The court-martial went badly from the point of view of Mercier, and the opinion both of the officer who was following the trial on behalf of Mercier and Boisdeffre and of the prefect of Paris police was that Dreyfus would be acquitted. Indeed, Dreyfus's lawyer told Dreyfus on the eve of the last day of the trial, if these judges have not been ordered to condemn you, tomorrow you will go home a free man. Well, but the next day, the general staff went into action. Major Henri took the stand and perjured himself, saying that he had received information from a reliable source that the traitor was Dreyfus. When he was asked what that source was, he refused. He said there are some things that even an officer's combat hat, a kepi, does not know. So that if there is such a separation between an officer's head and his hat, there's surely a separation between his head and his tongue. That would not have probably swung the day, but Patit de Clam went to see the president of the tribunal and handed him the secret dossier with the minister's moral order, strongest moral order, to make sure that the judges read the dossier. They read the dossier and they convicted Dreyfus to perpetual imprisonment in a fortified enclosure and to military degradation. Well, we're going to make the rest of this story very short. Dreyfus was sent to Devil's Island, Now, he was to spend almost 5 years on Devil's Island. In 1899, the highest court of France, the Cour de Cassation, overturned the judgment of the Paris court-martial and sent him to stand a new court-martial in Rennes, which took place beginning in the summer of 1899. At that point, everybody in Europe, except the anti-Dreyfusard in France and the general staff of the French army, was convinced that Dreyfus was innocent for reasons that I will come back to. The general expectation was that at Rennes he would be acquitted. But once again, he was convicted, though this time by only a 5-2 vote of the tribunal, and he was convicted to perpetual imprisonment for treason with extenuating circumstances. Now, it's hard to imagine what the extenuating circumstances can be for treason. Also, the officers who convicted him wrote a letter to the Minister of War asking that he be spared a military degradation. They were clearly holding their noses when they convicted him and yielding to the extraordinary pressure of the army, of its top brass, all of which was present in the Rennes courtroom. Dreyfus was pardoned by the President of France upon the urging of the Prime Minister and the Minister of War, who were completely convinced of his innocence. But he resumed the struggle for his exoneration. And indeed, but all this took a vast amount of time. In 1906, I've always a tendency to say 2006, but it's 1906, the Cour de Cassation overturned the judgment of the Rennes tribunal and declared Dreyfus completely innocent. There were none of the charges against him. He survived. The parliament passed the law that reintegrated him into the army, and he was made a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor. Now, how did all this come about? It came about because of the struggle of Dreyfus's brother, Mathieu, who was the initial champion, who believed in his brother's innocence totally, and gathered around him an increasing number of others who could not believe in Dreyfus's guilt, principally because there was no motive. Reasonable people could not come to grips with the fact that someone who had no reason to commit a crime so heinous would have committed him. So there was a growing band of people of all stripes, but most prominent among them were important politicians such as Clemenceau and Jaurès, leading intellectuals who worked tirelessly on Dreyfus's behalf. The other reason it was possible to overturn Dreyfus's conviction was a series of the most extraordinary indiscretions and coincidences. For instance, the handing over of the secret dossier to the Paris court martial was a crime under French law. The tampering with the documents was an additional crime a use of fraud, which is in France very severely punished. When Mercier, the Minister of War, was leaving office, he instructed his subordinates to burn the secret dossier so that no trace would remain of what had been done. But bureaucrats are bureaucrats, and he was disobeyed. A copy of the dossier, in fact, the original of the dossier secret, survived in the files of the Section de Statistique, and in due course came into the hands of Major Picard, who became the head of the Section de Statistique and was totally incorruptible. So that crucial piece of evidence was preserved, and it was like a time bomb that in due course exploded under the general staff. A second bizarre indiscretion was that of the President of the French Republic, who told his personal physician that Dreyfus was not convicted on any evidence that was presented in court, but on the basis of secret information that was given to the court martial. Well, the doctor Gibert, was anyway convinced of Dreyfus's innocence because of the lack of motive, and he rushed to Mathieu and gave him this information. Now, Mathieu would not have been able to use it to attack the judgment because it would have been his word against the word of everyone in the army. But 2 years later, we're now in 96, two of the most anti-Semitic papers in France published articles referring openly to the existence of the secret dossier and calling on the government to reveal it, because they said the revelation of what was in the secret dossier would allay all doubts about Dreyfus's guilt. Of course, when Mathieu saw this, he jumped in exultation and waited to see whether the government would deny these articles, issue a denial. The government said nothing. And that, of course, gave Mathieu the opportunity to get Lucie Dreyfus to file a petition for the review of the Paris court-martial on the ground that the procedure had been corrupted by the introduction of the secret evidence and that Dreyfus's rights had been violated. Just about the same time, another paper published a copy, facsimile, of the bordereau, which for the first time gave Mathieu the opportunity to have leading handwriting experts in Europe compare that handwriting to Captain Dreyfus's handwriting, and their opinion was the two were not the same. If you think that is enough by way of coincidences, there was yet one more. There are two more, but this here is the first of the two. A copy of the bordereau was pasted on walls in Paris. The posters that Mathieu had made and paid for, and also it was sold in kiosks. And one day, a stockbroker who had done a lot of business with Esterhazy bought a copy of the bordereau, looked at it, and he said, "But this is the handwriting of Esterhazy." And then he went with that information also to Mathieu. But here comes the really extraordinary coincidence, and it brings back into action Schwarzkoppen's wastebasket. One day, the charwoman, who normally stole the papers from the wastebasket of Schwarzkoppen, brought to the Section Statistique a little express letter, a petit bleu, which happened to be addressed to Major Esterhazy. It was Schwarzkoppen writing to Esterhazy in terms that made it clear that there was a business relationship between them. Now, Picard was by then, as I said, the head of the Section de Statistique, and he was a man of extraordinary probity. And at that point, he examined the contents of the dossier secret, came to the conclusion that there was nothing in it that incriminated Dreyfus, and he proceeded to investigate the case of Esterhazy, came to the conclusion that Dreyfus was innocent, that an innocent man was rotting on Devil's Island, and the traitor was Esterhazy, and he went with that information to his superiors, to the chief of staff, who was still Boisdeffre, and to the minister of war, who was then General Billot. And he said, well, we must do something to release Dreyfus from Devil's Island, because if we don't do it, the family will find out what has happened, and the consequences for the army will be appalling. There were some extraordinary exchanges between Picard and the deputy chief of staff, Gons, General Gons, which have come down practically with the force of myth. In one of those exchanges, Gons said to Picard, what do you care if that Jew rots on Devil's Island? And Picard said, well, what you're saying is abominable, and the truth will be known. And Gons said, no, not, it won't be known if you keep your mouth shut. And Picard said, no, I will not go to my grave with that knowledge, having kept silent about it. There was another exchange, which is crucial, in which it was explained to Picard by Gons that the honor of two generals, perhaps three, is at stake. And that is a crucial statement because it goes directly to the most extraordinary aspect of the Dreyfus affair. It is probably certain, almost certain, that by 1896, Boisdeffre and Mercier and Billot, the top figures in the army, understood that Dreyfus was innocent. And probably after Picard's revelations, they understood that Esterhazy was the traitor. Nevertheless, they decided to oppose the judicial review of the Paris judgment. It was known as La Révision. They decided to oppose the Révision with all means. Why? Because to some extent, doubtless, they were concerned about criminal liability for what was done during the Paris court-martial. And also because the notion that Dreyfus was guilty had become a shibboleth for right-wingers in France. If you were for the Révision, it meant that you were not a real Frenchman. It meant that you did not respect the army. It meant that you were not willing to see to it that France was strong. And in the course of this defense against the Révision, in the course of trying to prevent the truth from coming out, the General Staff engaged in a series of other criminal activities, including collusion, outright collusion with Esterházy. I think I'm going to stop this fascinating tale right now, and I'm going to simply ask you to think with me about how such a thing could be possible. Why would the top generals in the French army and their immediate subordinates collude with Esterházy? Why would the question of not admitting that a mistake had been made take on such extraordinary importance? I think there are several reasons. First of all, you cannot overestimate the influence of a particularly virulent form of anti-Semitism that had swept over France. France, as you know, was the first country in Europe to emancipate Jews, to give them full civic rights. Jews succeeded brilliantly in France, and not only in banks, but in the university, in the arts, in all the liberal professions. Their success excited a tremendous envy and hostility, because they were taking over turf that many thought should be reserved to normal Catholic Frenchmen. The form the anti-Semitism took was no longer the traditional church-backed anti-Semitism or church-taught anti-Semitism. It was racial anti-Semitism and economic anti-Semitism. In 1886, Edouard Drumont, a rightist, far-rightist writer and anti-Semite, published a book called La France Juive, Jewish France, a printing of 100,000 copies was bought up within weeks, and it was reprinted 200 times, if you can imagine such a thing, and became a sort of Bible and manual of French anti-Semitism, which at its height during the Dreyfus Affair would have left nothing to be desired for the ideologues of Nazi Germany. Those of you who will examine the materials in the Dreyfus collection in this library will see what I mean. In 1992, Dumont founded a daily newspaper, France Libre, which had a huge circulation, largest circulation of any daily newspaper, and its principal activity was going after Jews and exposing scandals in the French government circles. So the anti-Semitic background was enormously important in the conception of Dreyfus's guilt, and also in, I think, making it possible for otherwise decent people to to tolerate the notion that an innocent man was on Devil's Island. I should say that there were real pogroms in France in connection with the Dreyfus affair. They happened with particular intensity in February 1898, when Zola was tried for criminal libel against the army. Zola was the author of J'accuse, which was really an open letter to the president of the French Republic, in which, in a totally prescient manner, without access to documents, he laid out the entire horrible and ugly story of the machinations against Dreyfus. He was convicted of criminal libel, and rioting broke out in every major town and city in France. Enormous destruction of property, the army, the cavalry, and so on had to be called out. Even worse, rioting took place in French Algeria, where there were actually losses of life. So the anti-Semitism is one of the forces that made this possible. The other reason, curiously, is the national trauma that France suffered in the defeat in the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, in the course of which it lost two provinces, Alsace and northern Lorraine, and was subjected to a very, very heavy reparations. The war was lost because of the incompetence of French leadership. French soldiers were perfectly good, in fact, heroic. The generals were awful. After the defeat, the empire, of course, fell. The emperor was Louis-Napoleon III, and the republic was born. Very difficult birth. And in that rather shaky Third Republic, the army became sort of the favorite child. The French nation wanted to rebuild her army, to modernize it, to equip it better, to give it a proper general staff, good leadership, so that the provinces could be brought back to France so that Germany could be, in its turn, crushed. And through the many financial scandals of the French Republic, through many anti-republican attempts that really began with the Republic's establishment in 1874 and continued through the end of the Dreyfus affair, the army was the institution that to the French seemed to incarnate the best of what there was in France, so that putting the honor of the French army in question was intolerable. So these, I would say, were the circumstances that made such gross abuse of power and perversion of justice possible. Because my hay fever has just been heard from. Because I think it's wrong to think of the Dreyfus affair as a judicial mistake. It wasn't really that. It was an abuse of power. It was a case of the authorities, of the military top brass, knowingly bringing about the conviction of a crime of a man who would otherwise have been acquitted. Dreyfus's imprisonment on Devil's Island was, of course, appalling. The climate of Devil's Island is awful. Permanent tropical summer, but the worst aspect of his imprisonment was that it was the equivalent of almost 4.5 years of solitary confinement. He was the only prisoner on Devil's Island. He was not allowed to speak to the guards. The guards were not allowed to speak to him. So during that whole long time, he only spoke to the army doctor who would come to the island when summoned by the chief guardian or by the head of the prison system on Salvation Islands, who came to visit occasionally. Otherwise, he was speechless. Solitary confinement is said by those who have experienced it, such as Senator McCain, to be by far worse than physical torture. And studies have been made that show that indeed brain waves of people who have been kept in solitary confinement show a marked change, loss of cognitive power that occurs. It does not help to think about it when you know that solitary confinement is practiced in most American maximum security prisons, as well as, of course, it was practiced on Guantanamo, and surely is practiced today in Bagram and in other places. Now, I have to draw to a conclusion, and I will simply say what lessons I draw from the Dreyfus case that might be of some use to us today. The first lesson I draw is that if one cares about the rule of law, about a country being run according to those rules that are supposed to be applied, it needs to have an active, vigilant, and concerned citizenry. People who are willing to stand up against injustice. That is what happened in France when the Dreyfusards for 5 years fought without stop to bring about the correction of the injustice that had been done. We have seen that in our own case, maltreatment of detainees in Guantanamo and in other prisons that the Bush-Cheney administration had created was challenged by journalists, by lawyers, by law professors who have worked without compensation endless hours, continue to work on these cases, and they have been successful in pushing back some of the most repugnant practices that had become the norm. Another necessity is the existence of a fair and fearless judiciary. That was certainly the case in France. The Cour de Cassation that passed on the Dreyfus's case twice was subject to extraordinary vilification, personal threats, and so on, by the extreme right in France, but it did its work, and it did its work well. And so, too, the U.S. federal judiciary has been steadfast in its defense of the U.S. Constitution in this rather black era of our history. I can think of few things that are as moving as the opinion that Justice Stevens, at the time 89 years old, wrote in the Boumediene case, in which he explained that the right to habeas corpus could not be swept aside. I think it is also very important to remember that the rule of law is the ultimate protection of minorities that are detested or despised. That minority, of course, in France of the last third of the 19th century was Jews. Jews found their protection in the solidity of the Republican institutions. Of course, there's a lot to be said about what happened to Jews in France subsequently, but I won't. I would love to go into it, but I can't. You can't pick and choose among minorities. I think that so far as Jews are concerned in particular, Jews have an interest in standing, not only an interest, a necessity to stand against the oppression, discrimination against any other minority. And Jews have understood this very well in relation, for instance, to the struggle to give black Americans their full civic rights. Jews were at the bridge in Selma. They were there when blacks were registered to vote. They covered themselves with glory. And I think that we now have to realize that Muslims are entitled to the same protection from injustice that we want for Jews and we want for black Americans. That does not mean that I for a moment think that the detainees on Guantanamo were all innocent and should all have been let free. I only mean that they were entitled to be treated in accordance with United States law, and United States laws applied fairly and equally. Thank you very much. May I answer one question at a time?
Okay.
All right. It's easier because that way I don't forget number one while you stay number two. Well, yes, Picard was apparently quite convinced of Dreyfus's guilt after in the run-up to the Paris court-martial in 1894, when Picard was convicted, when Dreyfus was convicted, apparently Picard did not realize that the submission to the judges in secret of the dossier secret was a crime. But when he studied the dossier secret, the secret dossier, he came to the conclusion that he'd been wrong and that Dreyfus was clearly innocent. So that's certainly right. Second question.
The second question, throughout all this period, the subject of anti-Semitism was never brought up, was it? No one made the flat-out charge that anti-Semitism was involved.
Oh, no.
But it was never made.
No, I think that's not true. I think that for instance, in Zola's J'accuse, it's clear that he speaks of the anti-Semitism, and it was, I think, in the polemic that evolved, that was mentioned. The person who never said a word about French anti-Semitism was Dreyfus, who never in his journal written on Devil's Island even touched on that subject, because he felt that his being a Jew was his own business. He was a Frenchman and a French officer, and all he asked was to be given his rights under French law. And he had confidence. He had confidence to the end in the integrity of the French army. I should say, if I may open a parenthesis, most of the Jewish community apparently believed for quite a while that Dreyfus was guilty. Why? Because of the cult of the army and the fact that a tribunal of 7 French officers found him unanimously guilty. It was simply not thinkable that they could be wrong. And in fact, the attitude of the Jewish community was to try to pretend that they had nothing to do with the Dreyfus case, because they did not want it to spatter other Jews. There are two, how about the gentleman further back first, and then, you know, the last shall be first.
Were there other Jewish members of the French military establishment? Were there other Jewish, prominent Jewish officers?
Yes, there were, I believe, I might get the number wrong, but I think there were 9 Jewish generals at the time.
And did they suffer anything at all during this period of time?
No. They were not heard from. And there were about 300 Jewish officers.
And they maintained silence.
Well, I think that it is very difficult to say whether what their conversations were. But they did not, you know, break their own swords and try to resign their commissions or whatever. There's a wonderful short book that I would recommend to you, which is Léon Blum's Souvenirs of the Affair, in which he discusses the way in which the French community was torn by the Dreyfus case, because all those Jews who had succeeded brilliantly, who had passed the most difficult examinations, who had worked very hard, who attained high position, felt that he was, in a way, destroying their life's work. Yes, sir?
I just want to follow up on the question throughout the second question. You talked about the anti-Semitism, but the reason that the Dreyfus case you should care about is because of the universal lessons it teaches about the rule of law and about the threat to minorities when there's corruption or the violation or things like that. So I guess I'd like to understand more clearly what you think of the place of the relationship between these universal lessons and the scapegoating that occurred. Should we care about the Dreyfus Affair because of what it teaches us about anti-Semitism and the place of Jews in European history? It's not an either or.
No.
But what's the relationship between the universal lessons and this specific example?
Well, I'm sorry I did not develop that better. I blame it on Mr. McKnight and the limited time I have. But here's what I think. Today, in 2010, there is very little we need to be taught about the dangers of anti-Semitism or the consequences that it can lead to. I think we could learn still a lot about causes of anti-Semitism. What is it? What it is in societies, in human nature, that makes it endemic, like a cancer. But we don't really need to be taught much about the dangers of anti-Semitism, or the need to react against anti-Semitism. That is a lesson, I think, that has been taught very, very thoroughly, very painfully. So I don't believe that studying the Dreyfus Affair for that purpose it would not have made me want to write the book that I wrote. On the other hand, the Dreyfus Affair as an example of how things can go wrong in a society is very useful. I'll illustrate this by a personal statement. I'm not a historian, and when Yale University Press asked me to do this book, it was in this context of their series of books, which is about why does X matter? Well, you know, why does food matter? Well, of course, I knew something about the Dreyfus Affair anyway, and when it was put to me that I should write about why the Dreyfus Affair matters, I thought about it for about 3 minutes, and I could see why it matters, and I decided that that was something that I wanted to undertake.
Is there one more question from the audience?
You may have to pull teeth.
If not, would you please join me again in thanking Louis Begley?
Thank you.
To remind you, we have a small reception, but also have an opportunity to acquire or purchase the book, meet the author, and also view some of the fine pieces that we have which document the Dreyfus Affair in the Lee Library, which is directly behind you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.